Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford, a panel of experts discusses the keys to success for notable innovations and how corporate supply chains can build shared value and make change on a large scale. Topics include responsible e-waste recycling efforts that generate revenue, innovative methods to end child labor in the carpet industry, and environmental supply chain innovations. On Social Innovation Conversations. Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
And now, here is our presentation.
Right now, it's my pleasure not only to welcome you back from break, but to introduce our next panel. And this panel we're calling Sparks in the Chain, Leveraging Social Innovation. And I'm going to introduce our moderator and lead for this panel, which is Dr. Lakshmi Karan. She is the Director of Global Strategy for Riders for Health, which, if those of you who don't know about it, will see it's an intriguing and very innovative way to solve some of that last mile or last 100 yards distribution problem around health and other deliverables for people in emerging markets with lousy distribution systems. So I'll let you take that as a ball and give us a bit more background on that. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Karan and the panel. Doctor?
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin. Just quickly, Riders for Health tries to address the last mile distribution, like Kevin said. In when we say last mile, it's actually 100 miles, 150 miles, because if it was a mile, people would walk it. But I think I'm really honored to kind of moderate this panel to talk about social innovation, and in some ways really blessed that this session is happening in the afternoon, because we've got such rich information to build on. So I've thrown out all the questions that were prepared earlier for the panelists, because I think we're gonna make this more interesting after the break. Social innovation, you know, everything people have talked about this morning is innovation. Companies are constantly innovating how to bring more efficiency into the supply chains, but this particular panel is going to focus more on the social aspects, the social benefits of innovation. And while you're doing good business, how can you also be good partners in the community? And we've got a diverse panel that would look at all levels of the supply chain. We've heard speakers before refer to it as this vast network. You're going to hear views from ground level. You're going to hear views from 60,000 feet that looks at trends and everything in between. So hopefully we'll be able to capture all of the challenges and the opportunities of having innovative solutions in the supply chain. I'm going to briefly just mention the panelists, and then we'll have more chance for introductions after. To the far end is Dara O'Rourke, Associate Professor at UC Berkeley and co-founder of Good Guide, that was just mentioned in the previous speaker. Next is Stephen Rockhold, Global Program Manager for Product Reuse and Recycling at Hewlett-Packard. And, of course, lovely Nina Smith, Executive Director of Goodweave USA. I'm going to start off with Nina, and then we'll have 10 minutes for each of the other panelists. Throughout the day, we heard about the challenges of going down the tier of the supply chain. You're able to control a certain level, and then when you go to the second and third tier, you know, it becomes more challenging to hold people accountable for good practices. Nina and Goodweave actually work in an invisible tier. They're working in a hidden area. They're looking at the whole challenge of child labor in the carpet industry. It's not always visible. And so it brings a whole host of challenges of how you make this work, and I think it'll be really interesting for us to hear from you, Nina, about what this work is.
Thank you, Lakshmi. And the organizers of this great conference. I was asked to start off by telling you a little bit about the work of Goodweave. And first, I just wanted to mention, for those of you who don't know, About 1 in 6 children in the world today are exploited in the global economy. It's over 200 million children. And I tackle that problem in a very specific industry where the problem is prevalent, and that's in the handmade carpet industry. And part of the goal with this work that we do is to create a model for how we can tackle the same or similar problems in other supply chains as well. And the next time someone says, it can't be done, you can't deal with child labor, we have a model that's worked and that can be adapted and used. So we were asked not to do PowerPoints, but then some of us insisted that we had to use images, because we talk about supply chains, and supply chains are often people. And these are some of the people. This is a boy, maybe he's 6 or 7 or 8 in Afghanistan. The kind of child labor we deal with can be trafficked labor, bonded labor, local labor, family labor. Here's another image of a girl in Nepal in a small carpet factory. So that's the problem. And I want to now talk about the solution. Our model is market-driven. The theory, Goodweave's theory, is that when consumers have a choice to buy with their values, with all else being equal, they'll make the ethical choice. So we deal with child labor in sort of 3 levels. First, we have a certification label. The Goodweave label, which you saw on the first slide and you'll see again, assures consumers and companies that no child labor was used in the manufacture of the product. We create demand for the label through consumer campaigns, by engaging businesses, delivering value to businesses that use that label. And there's a very important point in the process when a company licenses with us. So an import brand in the U.S. or Europe becomes a licensee of Goodweave. That means they get the label on their product, and at that moment, their entire supply chain opens up to us to inspect on the ground in India, Nepal, and Afghanistan, which is where we work. And the photo up here now is a picture of our inspectors on the ground in Afghanistan, where we literally go inside of homes to monitor the supply chain. Once we get into the supply chain, which can go down 4 tiers, you know, we monitor factories, we monitor large factories, small factories, village-based loom sheds, and inside of homes. So we have to map that entire supply chain together with the licensees. We do find child labor, and when we do, we remove it. We require remediation. So the Goodweave label not only means that a product is child labor free, but that children are, when found, are rescued, provided long-term rehabilitation and education support by us, and also that we're implementing prevention programs in the weaving communities, which I can talk a little bit more about. There's the label. There's a unique number on that label, and that number can be traced back to where that rug was made. This is one of my favorite pictures of our daycare center in Mazar Sharif in Afghanistan. And so the other thing that we do with funds that we generate through the sales of the carpets, essentially license fees, is we implement programs in the weaving communities that the communities want for their children, to protect the children and prevent them from work. So that's daycare centers and early childhood education. That's school sponsorship for children at risk of going into the workforce. It can be worker awareness trainings, even adult literacy programs. We have a whole range of things that we do in the community. This is also a child in India. In India, we have we work in Uttar Pradesh state primarily, and we work village by village there, basically putting in education centers where there are no schools, despite the fact that in India, by law, there's supposed to be a school within 1 kilometer walking distance for every primary school-age child. They just aren't there, and that's one of the root causes of this problem. Some successes. Right now in the U.S., nearly 6% of all the imports of this product are certified by us as child labor free. And that's from rugs coming from all over the world. We're working in three countries. Of the products coming in here into this country from Nepal, we're certifying about 40%, which is pretty unprecedented in terms of market saturation for this kind of a certification initiative. And our goal is to work towards a tipping point, which we estimate to be at about 17% of the total market. So there's a point at which, whether or not we're certifying all the carpets, we feel like the industry itself will have been transformed, and that's really our goal. We've rescued nearly 4,000 children directly from exploitative labor. We provided education to nearly 11,000 children. We've more recently figured out how to be able to replicate what we do in a pretty good way. We recently launched in Afghanistan, which we were told probably wasn't doable, and now we're a year and a half in, and the first child labor-free certified rug is about to be shipped out of Afghanistan any day. Just a few challenges. Lakshmi asked us to talk about challenges. There are everyday operational challenges trying to do something like this, and I think one of the biggest ones is really being able to ensure the consistency of what we do from country to country and making sure that what we say that label means, it means, no matter, it means that, it means child labor free, no matter where in the world we're working, and that we run the system in the same way with the same kind of integrity. That's probably the biggest challenge. And, of course, market adoption and the way that you get a company to come on board. I'll just say, when I started this work 14 years ago, we were seen as an agitator. The industry didn't want anything to do with us. Now we have 100 brands working with us. We launched in Macy's about a year and a half ago, and we're building up product in Macy's and talking to other big retailers. So it's taking off, and I'll leave it at that. Let's see what else I had here. Yeah. One of the side benefits, of course, when you eliminate child labor is adult workers earn a better living when they're not competing with bonded laborers, bonded children for jobs. Thank you.
Thanks, Nina. We all heard again this morning about how corporations have to take responsibility for the environment and in the sourcing, as well as Jill very eloquently articulated, the disposal of the waste. It's a huge problem in most of the developing world, and as you're starting to increase consumerism, it's going to become an even bigger problem. So Steve and Hewlett-Packard have really pioneered an initiative in East Africa looking at e-waste, and when we were prepping for this session, I was really kind of drawn to a couple of things that he reiterated, which was working with local communities and generating revenues. So, you know, it's like a win-win-win-win-win-win. And, of course, I did push to say, let's hear about the challenges, so we'll see what he comes up with. But, Steve, on to you. We're going to have a short video before he shares his remarks.
With luck, we'll have a video to show here that'll give you a little bit.
As an engineer, I'm a person who loves gadgets. At the end of the life of a product that I really enjoy using, I have learned that I am a participant in e-waste in the world. The African economy is growing rapidly. So the demand for mobile phones, TVs, fridges, computers is increasing exponentially. And at the end of life, these become electronic waste. So there is need to proactively address this issue. Electronic waste is a resource, and it can be used to create green jobs and contribute to the economy. The East African Computer Recycling, in partnership with HP, offers a service that collects electronic waste from customers from the informal sector, non-governmental and governmental organizations, and processes it to HP's international health, safety and environmental standards. HP is committed to handling Africa's e-waste problem. We started this program in 2007, and the program has three components. The first one is research. We carry out research in the countries to find the magnitude of the problem, the available legislation. We participate in education, where we sensitize all stakeholders on the issue and the available solutions. And the third component is, where viable, we establish recycling facilities. Our vision is to see the East African Computer Recycling process more than 20% of all electronic West from the region. As a father, I have a responsibility to leave my children a good environment, not just social but physical. East African Computer Recycling is living proof that this model is both sustainable and scalable. We have designed it from the bottom up to demonstrate that you can bring together the informal sector, enterprise customers, and governments to solve a real problem.
Okay, great. So hopefully that gives everybody a visual idea of the project that I'll be talking about today, which is recycling in Kenya. And I'm here to report on behalf of the colleagues of mine that work out of Europe, Middle East, and Africa that actually did the work, you know, on the ground to help bring this to fruition. So the story starts with a very simple vision. The vision is to make sure that we can collect and properly recycle all e-waste as a profitable business, as a profitable enterprise. Because if it isn't profitable, quite frankly, it isn't going to last over time. But the real caveat to that statement is that it has to be done according to international standards. It has to be done properly along the way, because obviously you can take shortcuts and do better financially, but that's not acceptable here. So why Africa? Why did we choose Africa as maybe one of the first places to start? I think, first of all, the reality that by 2050, the predictions are that there'll be 3.6 billion inhabitants in Africa. And it's a region that's growing. People are becoming more wealthy. And business consumption is taking off. So there's high growth rates of new products, and also secondhand products are sold fairly widely across Africa. And as we all know, all these products, sooner or later, even if there is a secondary life to them, will eventually need to be addressed at end of life and recycled, hopefully. And some of our projections are that perhaps as early as 2020, Africa could be generating more waste for us than the EU. So that's sobering to think about. And yet, right now, our programs are fairly well developed in the developed countries. We have a recycling program that is available in basically 50 to 55 countries that covers about 80% of our market share. But then there are another 120 countries that we haven't yet been able to address that represent the remainder, and that's quite a challenge, okay? So this is a pilot to start to address that. And, again, the bottom line is, if done properly, collection and treatment of electronics is not hazardous. But if it's not done correctly, of course, it can create all sorts of problems, and that's the challenge, is to make sure that you do it properly. A very key ingredient to success here is the fact that the value of e-waste has increased tremendously over the last 10 years or so. If you look at the basic markets for gold, copper, steel, aluminum, all these commodities have all risen, and it's really shifted the equation from what was once always a cost burden to a situation now where you can often actually do this at a profit, again, if it's done correctly, and especially when labor rates are really low. So this facility is called East African Computer Recycling. Originally, the name has changed, and I'll speak to that in a second. And it was started as a partnership or kind of a joint initiative between ourselves at HP and an NGO called Kamara that's out of Ireland. Their role, as best I understand it, is that they take donated and used computers, move them into emerging economies, and then put together teaching materials. They train the teachers themselves and create an educational infrastructure. But part of that whole program that they manage is that they absolutely insist that there's a recycling infrastructure to go along with that, realizing that at some point they're going to have to deal with that as well. And therefore, we were able to partner and get the thing launched with that in mind. For us as a company, this was actually our second entity in Africa that's running under international recycling standards. We had an earlier one in the Republic of South Africa, but quite a bit more developed, although there are still challenges, than Kenya. And so this is actually represents our second go at it. As I said before, the two key ingredients here is that we want it to be financially self-sustaining and that we want it to be run with proper recycling standards. Those are two non-negotiables all the way along. And if successful, then this East African recycler would become, you know, a sub-regional hub, one of maybe three or four that could help us cover the continent and act as a model for other developing regions. What they do basically is they collect material. You saw the gentleman in the picture comes up to the door literally holding a burlap sack with material in it. And when you hear us speak about collection from the informal sector, that's exactly what we mean. I mean, it's literally people on walking bikes, small vehicles that are collecting things that they can carry and bring in, and they expect to get cash on the spot. This entity, obviously Camara, had a lot to do with our being able to get it off the ground because we knew that there was going to be volume there that would help sustain it from the beginning. But right from the get-go was bringing in about 20% of the material from the informal sector. And the whole plan is to not disrupt the informal sector, because collecting through the informal sector is fine. There's really nothing wrong with it. It's making sure that they're bringing it to us or anyplace else where it can be appropriately recycled. So very quickly, they were able to collect around 50 tons of IT. It's not a large amount of material on our scale, but plenty in a situation like this to get the thing going. And it launched back a little over a year ago now. Since that time, we've actually moved forward into almost a second stage. And there was a recognition that we needed an established recycler involved in this operation to really help them make sure that they are well grounded. And so a company called Reclaimed Appliances, which is also out of Ireland, has joined us in this partnership, maybe now a trifecta. And they're putting money into the operation, and they're starting to help it grow. They're moving it from Mombasa, where it started, into Nairobi. Bigger space, better connected, more properly positioned to bring in material from adjacent countries as well, because we recognize that the IT volume available in Kenya alone would not be sufficient to sustain. Okay, so it's an important element that we've got to be able to move material across borders, adjacent borders at least, to make this work as well. And the government has realized what's going on. We've reached out to them, and they've started to really support this operation as well. Obviously, they see the jobs and the growth and the ability to deal with a fairly thorny problem, so there's a lot available for them. So a few comments about our keys for success. I've mentioned already that, you know, recognizing that the e-waste has value and translating that, or based on the expectation that there's an opportunity to be financially viable here, to enforce the proper recycling standards, and to make sure that we don't disrupt the informal collection network. We want to make sure that they can stay in their business. You know, we think we've been able to bring opportunity awareness, and we've created partnerships now with NGOs, recyclers, and other OEMs. We've actually expanded this to an alliance. And also governments, and we've also put some of the seed funding into it. As far as top challenges, obviously achieving self-sustenance is not a given. Even though the elements are there for it, it takes good management to make that happen, and that's still a work in progress for sure. That attracting enough material, as I said, is a challenge and will continue to be a challenge. And meeting international recycling standards is also always a challenge. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Dar.
Before Dara starts to speak, one of the things that I noticed from this morning, I don't know how many of you heard Katrina in the low keynote and felt guilty about owning a cell phone, eating chocolate, or buying cotton. I was one of those. And one of the things that strikes you is brand is important for companies. Consumer behavior drives a lot of this change. And I think Dara's work in kind of raising awareness amongst consumers with Good Guide is critical to some of this. So over to you, Dara.
Thank you very much. So my main academic work at UC Berkeley is on studying global supply chains and the governance of global supply chains and developing better ways to measure and monitor environmental, social, health impacts up and down supply chains. But today I want to talk very briefly about an experiment that has spun out of UC Berkeley, which really is an experiment that is learning from and leveraging some of the social innovations that we've been hearing about all day today and that really have been emerging out of Silicon Valley and around the world that really, I think, are beginning to disrupt industries all around the world and are coming to global supply chains and are going to be disrupting global supply chains. One of the ways that the tech blogosphere talks about the innovation in Silicon Valley is a horrible buzzword, SOLOMO, which is big trends over the last couple of years around social, local, and mobile, that some of the hottest startups coming out are really innovating around social attributes, local attributes, mobile attributes. And I would add responsibility to that. So we're basically trying to learn from those trends, those technologies, and have been building consumer decision support tools that help consumers make better decisions around products and companies, to see the impacts of the choices they make and to really understand the impacts of supply chains. So we basically have been building this experiment off of three big trends. One is these revolutions in information technology that are going on disrupting, and these are the obvious ones like Facebook and Twitter and Skype. How many of you have Facebook accounts? Right, so we're studying all the new apps and websites that have emerged once your kids found out you were on Facebook. And those things that are popping up weekly that are the newest things, and they're way beyond just communication, like Uber disrupting taxis, Airbnb disrupting hotels, Kickstarter disrupting funding, Inocentive disrupting research even, all sorts of educational technologies, Change.org, Kiva, Yertle, as we heard about this morning. There's a huge amount going on that is really driving changes in how consumers and citizens interact with brands and retailers. So we're very interested in those changes and leveraging those changes, and really leveraging the demand that is coming from consumers for greater transparency. As we've heard from China to the US to Europe, all around the world, consumers want to know more about the products they're buying, where they come from, how they're made, under what conditions they're made, and what their real impacts are. So we've built, with GoodGuide.com, the largest database in the world of products and companies and their environmental, social, and health attributes. We've rated about 175,000 products from 5,000 companies across 10 product categories: consumer products, food, personal care, household chemicals, toys, electronics, apparel, appliances, and built really a platform for managing complex data that's coming from over 1,500 different data sources around the world that can come from workers in China through a program like Labor Voices or factory data like Majun's data, all the way up through information that socially responsible investors are tracking on companies and products. And then we've taken that information and turned it into simple web and mobile tools to deliver all the information, this complex life cycle, health hazard, risk assessment data in a simple form for consumers to make better decisions. Now also consumers, retailers, brands, others. So we rate both products and companies, go all the way into the specific ingredients within a product as well as the company behind the product, its full environmental, social, health impacts, a kind of life cycle approach where we're pulling public data from around the world, aggregating it, weighting it, analyzing it, and turning it into decision support right when a person makes a decision. Whether they're standing in a Safeway here in Palo Alto trying to choose between products in the aisles, they spend about 20 seconds choosing between products while they're standing in the store, or they're online. They're on Amazon.com, and in the middle of a decision-making process, we want to give them the right information in the right form at the right moment that helps them make better decisions. This is hard to see, but this is a browser plugin that we were actually encouraged to develop by Andrea, who's here in the audience from Google, that we built without Amazon's permission, but in your browser, you can take our data, and anywhere you go on the web, whether you're on Amazon.com, Walmart.com, Target, Diapers.com, you can pull information on what matters to you, create your own personal filters, and see if this product passes or fails your personal filter, and then we want to help you find better products ultimately, at better prices that people like you like. So we want user reviews, price, quality, and environmental, social, health information. To date, still modest. We're not Twitter or Facebook, but we have about 2 million visitors per month to the Good Guide network, about 1 million downloads of our iPhone app. So we have a statistically significant number of consumers around the world using this information to make decisions. And now we're really working to get this information out, to get through an API all this content out into Google product search or into eBay's product comparison tools, into other people's mobile apps, web apps, and get it out to help those retailers or those commerce sites or those social consumption sites to have the information that consumers increasingly want to know. Every consumer cares about price and quality, but we've learned through, again, studying some of the most interesting web startups in Silicon Valley that are really leveraging behavioral psychology or game mechanics to understand what really drives consumers to make decisions, what really drives people to change a consumption practice or a product choice. And that, it turns out, consumers are not just making rational optimizations comparing price and quality. They care about what people like them like. They care about status, peer influence, all sorts of other things that we're trying to bring into this process and really help us understand how they make decisions. We've also been building tools now for brands and retailers to take the same platform and data and to help a retailer, for instance, to compare products and companies against the attributes they care about. So across the US and Europe, we see more and more retailers establishing their own sustainability standards, or in the case of Walmart, initiating Sustainability Consortium, Sustainable Apparel Coalition. Across every retailer has their own system. We can basically leverage all this data to show them how vendors and products perform in their own system, comparing, again, all the way at the product level up to vendor level, down supply chains, getting, again, into specific ingredients that they may have on restricted substance lists or ingredients that they see that their consumers are concerned about. So as we see in the last year, a hot topic like bisphenol A blow through the U.S. and go from a chemical that only nerds like me debated to moms across America debating bisphenol A in baby bottles and not wanting products with bisphenol A. And now that's going into canned food, it's going into receipts. A retailer can track that consumer sentiment and understand both scientifically what matters in their supply chain, but also what matters to consumers. We're really also trying to leverage the innovation around crowdsourced knowledge and crowdsourced information that more and more people really, unfortunately, I hate to break to you, trust corporations less and trust NGOs and their peers more. They look to people like them or people they trust for advice, even if they don't have better information than you all have. It is more credible. So how do we bring in the wisdom of experts, whether it's academics or NGOs or your peers, to help people make better decisions? So we're basically trying to pull this information together to help not only consumers, but retailers, brands, institutional purchasers, working with some universities, hospitals, others, to help them evaluate both hot spots down their supply chain, what matters scientifically in assessing the environmental or social or health attributes of a product or a company, but also hot button issues, what matters to consumers, what's really driving decisions around purchase. Help them evaluate products and companies, compare, see how they benchmark along different systems, and really try to identify both risks, the downside, potential problems, and opportunities where there's potential to either promote good practice or promote innovations that are going on. Through this little experiment with Good Guide, I think we've identified there's a massive trend, which we've heard over and over today, towards greater transparency in the marketplace. And we really think this is an unstoppable trend, that more and more consumers, more and more retailers, more and more universities, hospitals, the U.S. government, everyone will be demanding to know more about your product and your supply chain than ever before. They'll be able to get more information, and they will share more information through Weibo in China or Twitter or Tumblr or Path or whatever it is, and getting that information out. So we see this kind of trend towards transparent sustainability as both a real threat for some brands and a real opportunity, that brands and companies can be leveraging it and should be looking at the social innovations going on here and around the world to bring in these new types of information, to bring in these new multi-stakeholder dialogues and really leverage them to identify hotspots, hot button issues, risks, opportunities, and to move from an attempt to basically hide your supply chain to being much more open, transparent, and authentic about a two-way conversation with your consumers about what's going on in your supply chain. I think the future of marketing and communication will really be around authentic, two-way, open conversations where we all and you all can learn what consumers really care about, and you can be communicating information from your supply chain out to them, admitting both your problems and your challenges, but also showing how you're working towards improving your products, and showing ultimately how you are able to work with consumers, NGOs, academic stakeholders to co-design and co-develop more sustainable, healthier, better products going forward. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. I'm actually going to follow the previous moderators and actually ask a few questions myself before I turn it over, but there's going to be plenty of time for your engagement. So this morning, Alex said, and I quote, "Business case makes social benefit possible. Social benefit makes the business case stronger." So Nina, as an NGO that is trying to connect the social benefit to the business case and you're working, how do you build coalitions and kind of bring to highlight the shared interests and shared value when you're starting conversations that often might be very difficult for companies?
So that conversation has changed a lot since we started doing this work. I've been talking to companies about their supply chains for 14 years and in this specific industry. So initially, we focused on early adopter companies. So we looked at companies that that had a moral motivation to do this work. So those companies were easier sells. We had to show them how we did our work, demonstrate credibility, and get them on board. And then once we had product in the marketplace, so that had to happen first before we could get product in the marketplace. We needed product in the marketplace that was certified in order to begin to engage consumers in the dialogue, if you consider consumer stakeholders here, which they are. Then we could begin to talk to consumers. We do that through a variety of ways, advertising, public service ads, very targeted to the kinds of people who buy high-end luxury products. So consumers got involved, started making some choices, and then more companies were looking at what their competitors were doing. That there were high-end luxury companies out there that were selling products that were certified. Their direct competitors began to get engaged where they wouldn't before because their competitors were selling certified products. And they wanted to compete. So we gained momentum that way. There are other issues as well. So we began to build a business case that way. Then we began to do more consumer awareness. More product was in the marketplace, more diversification of product, more capacity to push it out there to a more variety of consumers. We began to talk to bigger companies who are concerned with risk. So that's a part of how you engage companies in the discussion, companies like Macy's who are concerned with what happens when there's a problem in the supply chain and what that does to their reputation. There's also sort of the policy side and things that are happening at the governmental level that then motivate further new kinds of companies. And I'm focusing on the corporate stakeholders. There are more that are involved in this, of course, but they're actually right here in California. Maybe most of you probably know about the California Transparency and Supply Chains Act, which actually further enables us to engage companies. And in fact, if you go to the Macy's website, this is a reporting law. For those who know about it, requires companies of a certain size doing retail business in California to report what they're doing to prevent trafficked and forced labor from their supply chains. If you go to Macy's website, actually GoodWeave certification on carpets is the only thing they're reporting that they're doing about this right now. So that's kind of responding to what's the business case, but those are ways that we are able to engage the corporate stakeholders in the dialogue, which are the hardest ones.
Thanks. Steve, I think I've been in CSR for a while and philanthropy, and I kind of know the trajectory of how this conversation goes. You have an innovation, you have a pilot, then you show results, and then there's this question of, so show me sustainability.
then there's this question of show me how it can scale sustainably and have the impact. So there's this, you know the path you're on once you have a successful pilot. What are your thoughts around the risks of scaling, the risks of kind of growing this model beyond East Africa?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, what I've shown so far and what we've talked about is more the micro view of one particular recycling entity and how to deal with it on a local basis. But the macro problem is really that we've got a large number of countries that need to be covered, none of which has a particularly large amount of volume, none of which has a very good recycling infrastructure. So certainly you're not going to walk out and expect to just find recyclers that can already meet the types of standards that we hold ourselves to and that we hold them to. And you know, you start with that issue, and there's certainly nowhere near enough resources to replicate this many, many times over. I mean, it just takes an awful lot of work. So from that standpoint, it's kind of a classic supply chain issue, right? Do you want to have local recycling in every single country, or are you gonna figure out some kind of more of a regional approach to it where you can then aggregate volume, bring it in from other countries, whether they be adjacent or a little bit more further removed, and really focus your energy on a smaller number of sites that are very, very well managed. And it doesn't take very much modeling to understand that the regional approach is the better way to go. It's just not affordable otherwise. But there's one huge barrier to that, and that is that unlike moving most commodities, this is waste. And so there's a lot of regulation about moving waste across boundaries. The Basel Convention exists. It's there to prevent the poor practices that have happened in terms of dumping material from developed on developing countries. And that's a very legitimate thing. However, if you can't move it, then you're forced back to the other solution, and there's a lot of issues around that, even that start with what constitutes waste, and if product that hasn't yet been tested and proven working can't be moved because it's waste, then it ends up in the waste bin sooner than it would otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it ends up in the waste bin in places where you don't want it to end up in the waste bin. And so the whole problem just kind of, you know, builds on itself. So that's the macro issue, and that's what we're dealing with. So in terms of replicating this model, I wouldn't want to have to replicate it in every country. I don't think that that's a sustainable way to go. On the other hand, we're going to have to break down some of these other issues and really get all of us, ourselves, NGOs, other stakeholders, to agree on where we want these materials recycled and what rules we want those facilities to follow, and then work very diligently together to get the material to those places. I think that's a short synopsis of the problem.
Great. So Dara, mm-hmm. I must apologize. I know we had prepared on some questions, but I think this morning's data that was shared kind of has made me change the question. So, you know, 10 years ago when I was looking at factories in China, one of the things that came up is overtime violations. Then I was really struck when I saw the number out there. It says 90% of Chinese factories. And I'm going, well, that was the problem a decade ago, and I'm sure it was the problem 2 decades ago. And why is it still a problem? And, you know, who better to ask than you? As you're looking at trends and, you know, what's been happening as companies are getting more aware and getting more engaged, but why are there these bottleneck issues? And does something else have to happen, or is this just a matter of time that another 20 years it'll come down?
No, I don't think we have time for that. So not to pick on any specific companies, but just, you know, over the last year or so, watching the story with Apple, I think, has really been instructive. Mm-hmm. We've seen with Apple almost a repeat of Nike 1997 through 2000, and it's been identification of massive violations of overtime, wages and hours issues, other issues in their supply chains, non-compliance. And the response was first deny it, then codes of conduct, then monitoring systems, then a policing system, and then join the FLA, then disclose your supply chain. And it literally is stuff that Nike did in the late 90s that we see Apple, one of the most innovative companies in the world, and continued noncompliance in wages and hours and the other issues. And it really, on the one hand, it's actually positive. Apple, I would argue, is the least transparent, most secretive consumer products company in the world, and yet they are being forced to disclose their supply chain, to work with NGOs in China for the first time ever, to let people into their factories like the FLA, to admit they have factories, like Steve Jobs didn't even admit he had factories, right? So that's great, they're making progress, and I would argue the only threat to Apple's brand is consumer perceptions around labor rights and environmental rights. It's you know, for better or worse, it's not going to be Samsung or HTC that brings them down. It's their own reputation and their own response to these labor and environmental things. So the big question for me is, can Apple leapfrog the last 20 years of all the same stuff and go beyond just doing codes and monitoring and private policing that we talked about? And so that really is asking them to learn from that and say, we're going to move from the kind of private policing to collaborative problem solving, which Hao Li talked about this morning also. That is moving to root cause analysis. That's moving to real intensive learning with multiple stakeholders where they draw on all the bad news, they're open and honest about it, and they build systems, you know, to be totally frank and put it back in their face, build systems that are as innovative in this issue, manufacturing, as they are in every other aspect of their company. They've revolutionized six industries, right? They've transformed computing, music, desktop publishing, phones. They have to transform manufacturing. They've got to think differently about, you know, they've got a model that's basically not sustainable with Foxconn. Foxconn has 30% turnover per month of employees. They can't continue to scale up the scale that they need to. They've got to rethink the way they have all these other industries, what design to manufacturing to end of life means and how they do it. And I think there's some great lessons, local for local production, all sorts of new innovative thinking about this. But to me, we can't wait another 20 years. We can't have them continue to make kind of similar path. And to see 10 years from now, one of my colleagues at MIT, Rick Locke, has done great big N statistical analysis showing all this monitoring is leading to no improvement in compliance rates around key indicators in these factories. No investment in codes and monitoring, no improvement in overall non-compliance. That's really pretty depressing. So we've got to think different about this, really innovate.
All right, we're going to open it up for your questions. Yes.
As one that has done a lot of sustainable product innovation over the last, gosh, 6 or 7 years now, I know that trying to create a sustainable product is a little like playing whack-a-mole. You fix one thing and another thing goes out of whack. So, for example, you might go down in materials, but the material you replace it with requires more energy. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the question, and because of that, there's an awful lot of greenwash out there in the world in terms of they'll pay attention to one metric, but they don't disclose that this other metric's gone out of whack. So in your scale there, how do you account for the what I call the whack-a-mole and greenwash phenomena in sustainability?
Yeah, great question. And I think it's a huge issue, not just for companies. It's an issue for NGOs that target one chemical at a time, for governments that develop restricted substance lists, for retailers that put a list of 8 bad chemicals, and then we see people just moving around those. And then we have no human tox data on the ones they replace it with. So this is a big issue. We use environmental life cycle approaches, which are basically the science of comparing apples, oranges, and watermelons, and trying to bring in the overall environmental impact of a product from raw material extraction to manufacturing to use to disposal. That is a young, early science, but we've seen some progress over the last 5 or 6 years on simplified methods for trying to understand your big, big impact categories. And I think we're getting better at identifying the big hotspots, the big ticket items in a product supply chain, and making sure that we don't send things too far out of whack. But we really do have a problem with this as we regulate, our government regulates chemical by chemical. And so, just like with my example of bisphenol A, it becomes the chemical du jour. Well, bisphenol S pops into things. Is it better or worse? We don't know, right? And we see it in electronics industry where we're moving from one chemical to, you know, another chemical where we have almost no data on it. So it's an issue. We basically try to approach it with holistic hazard and chemical risk assessment on the health side, environmental life cycle assessment on the environment side, and broad social impact assessment. But all of these things are things where I think we're trying to, as academics and engaged scholars, to get better at identifying what matters most, and can we at least be targeting the big ticket items in a category to bring them down first before we worry about things that aren't as important.
Can we go here?
One common thread in your remarks is, you know, reliance on labels, standards for e-waste, or in your case, you know, a guide that you've created which is comprehensive. from the consumer's point of view, I'm wondering if you could comment, you know, how is a consumer supposed to sort through the profusion of labels, standards, sources of information? I think it's a lot to expect from a typical shopper to sort through all that, and whom do they trust?
Yeah, so I'll start with GoodGuide. Our strategy has been build a platform for transparency in which we can basically pull in all of that information. There are over 300 eco certifications in the U.S. market alone, probably 400 or 500 if you include Europe. No consumer wants to do a research project in the 20 seconds they're in the aisle. So we try to bring in all of the kind of credible certifications, third-party assessments, the government data, NGO data, academic data, and then put it in a simple form. Most consumers want a yes-no piece of advice. Is this product safe for my family or not? Is it socially responsible? Does it meet my ethical standard or not? So our strategy has been give them a simple way to filter, but then be one click away from the detailed data. And if they want to go into the carbon issues or the labor rights or the animal rights, whatever, they can get there. But you're right, very few consumers want to drill down into the complexity of the data.
I can comment for the electronics industry. It's a good news, bad news situation. So at the enterprise level or public sector sales, there's actually something called EP, which is an evaluation protocol. It's an eco label that's available that I think does a very effective job of making good information available to purchasing agents who are buying for public sector enterprise type customers. And it uses all the right aspects of competition and things to make sure that your products are registered. However, that doesn't help really the average consumer. I mean that still wasn't the target audience, and even though they're moving that direction, I think it's still somewhat elusive. There's just so much information bundled into that it's a little tough, but they are heading that direction. So good news in the more of the commercial side, not so good news in the consumer side.
Well, a couple comments I wanted to make. One is we're talking about the role of consumers, and yet I think we do have to admit that it's questionable yet how much consumers actually want to know and whether or not they are really making choices with this information. Because in my experience, I showed you pictures of the children who are being exploited here. When someone goes to buy this product, that is pretty low on the list of criteria that they use still. When making a purchase, and to the Apple story, as far as I know, Apple did not feel a hit in sales when the story broke. You might know more about that than I. So I really question how much consumers want to know. I think there are groups of us, I would include myself there, that really want to know a lot and research it. That said, our strategy has been in this particular product with a particular kind of high-end luxury consumer. Our strategy to get the consumer to make the choice is essentially to brand ourselves. You know, we have extensive public service advertising that reaches, that goes out in interior design and brand and these kinds of magazines that either interior designers or, you know, women who are redoing their homes are reading. We do a lot of education at the point of sale. So the most in the product we're dealing with, which is different than maybe certain products that are being sold online, customers take their time in making the decision. It's a high-priced product, and the salesperson plays a major role in helping the consumer make the choice. So we have to educate them and then hope that they're going to do their job at the point of sale. But it's a very, very tough issue.
Yep, here in the center.
This might be a little bit out of scope, but we've been talking about B2C, right, business to consumer, and I think a lot about business to business. So what I'm wondering is if I've heard of sales deals where you have a product, right, not a supplier to something that'll go into your own product, but a finished product. I've heard of sales deals hinging on proper disposal of e-waste, but I haven't really heard of any sales deals hinging on good supply chain management, and I'm curious as to whether you've seen any examples of B2B consumers using resources like the ones that you're talking about here, if there's corollaries, if there's other stuff that's available, if there's other conversations going on.
I can just tell you from my experience, it doesn't happen often, but there are there are large institutional buyers that care a lot about specific issues. It tends not to be broad. They'll tend to have some certain issue, and they'll want just an infinite amount of data on that particular issue, and we go to great lengths to deal with that on almost a daily basis. But it's a moving target, which makes it difficult for us because you never know quite where somebody's going to be coming from.
Yeah, we're seeing it all over. So from Walmart, which is, you know, the largest retailer in the world and also very clearly a value retailer going for kind of low-cost, affordable products, they've made a huge initiative, which they're rolling out now, of evaluating all of their vendors in 60 key categories for their sustainability performance. Then many of those top-tier vendors, like Procter & Gamble, are then evaluating all of their vendors, and we're seeing this trickle down where more and more people from the GSA, the U.S. government purchasing organization, to major retailers all around the world are demanding more, wanting to know more, and scorecarding. And it's early, right? We're still kind of get the data, but it's going to translate into vendors being kicked out of systems and others getting more orders. And so we're absolutely seeing it across categories. And to the consumer question, we do now look at hundreds of thousands of actual consumer decisions every month. The thing that is clear, mainstream Americans will switch purchases around health attributes. Yeah. If a product contains toxic chemicals in their baby shampoo, they will switch. They will, very small percent will change around social attributes, labor rights down a supply chain. So we have very strong data on health, environment and social, less strong. The product has to be equal or better quality within 10% of the price point and then perform better sustainably for you to be able to really compete.
And I would just add that because of that reality, what we're actually trying to do is to get major companies that are sourcing the product to work with their suppliers to convert them to, in our case, child labor-free supply chain. So it really is a business-to-business transaction. We talk about consumer awareness, but right now Macy's is reevaluating all of their suppliers for this particular product category and slowly converting them over to get certified. So it's a process. There was something else. I just wanted to add that I think earlier someone mentioned the iSeal Alliance, and there are a group of organizations that we're a member of the iSeal Alliance, and there are a group like the Forest Stewardship Council, Fair Trade Labeling Organization, Marine Stewardship, that because we've met certain standards within that's required to be part of iSeal, we are all considered best in class in terms of standard systems and certification labels. And we are talking very actively there about how to together create packages for merchandisers and big companies. So because there is a lot of frustration on the company side about the array of standards and the fact that they can't all serve everything they need. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah, this is basically directed towards substance. It's a very high concern for your involvement. The cosmetic industry is basically self-regulated. The FDA doesn't really look at them, and they don't have the jurisdiction other than the labeling issues. When you look at products and you're seeing ingredients or chemical substances, what are you using as a reference to say whether that is toxic or not? Because if you go to Europe under the REACH program, you're just replete with chemicals. I think it's 83 chemicals now that are on the SBHC. And when you look at a standard bottle of hand cream or something, you find all of these chemicals that are hazardous over there that are being passed through, including nanomaterials that are still under investigation.
Right. Yeah, great question. So we basically take a consumer product category like personal care, and we'll pull out all the ingredients, and then we have to do a process to fix for misspellings and synonyms and common names. We connect to CAST, the international system for tracking, and then we screen those against 60 or 70 different international hazard lists. So we'll look for carcinogenicity, we'll go to IARC, the International Association for Research on Carcinogens, as well as Prop 65 here in California, as well as NTP. So three or four on carcinogenicity, mutagenicity, reproductive health, endocrine disruption, neurotox, skin irritation. And what we do basically is show consumers both kind of regulatory compliance as well as we can offer for people who want a precautionary filter. So if you choose that you want to avoid any chemical of concern, whether it is kind of a known regulatory hazard that has been controlled in the U.S. or Canada or Japan, or it is an emerging controversial ingredient that you just want to avoid, you can do either in good guide. But what we try to do is look to authoritative bodies and be at the kind of cutting edge of what is academic or government knowledge about the chemical, and then allow a filter for precaution for those who want to go further.
One there.
I have a question for you, Dara. I'm glad you talked about which of the three dimensions, health, society, or environment, has the highest influence of consumer behaviors, and I was expecting health to be the answer. And I think that's because health is personal and tangible. You know, environment and society is something that it's impacting other people that we don't know. But increasingly, stakeholders such as governments are trying to sell an environmental societal agenda in different ways by talking about health impacts. So, for example, AB 32 in California was sold not on the back of environmental concerns, but on the back of, you know, health and jobs concerns. So my question is this. Have you looked at ways to maybe present the society and environmental ratings in ways that consumers can relate to it in more personal, tangible, and maybe positive ways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. We've struggled with that. We started off, as I mentioned, as a team of academics at Berkeley, and when we started out, we basically were a bunch of nerds trying to present complex life cycle assessment information. So, you know, bottle of whatever shampoo has palm oil in it, and my science team would say, okay, we need to present the biodiversity impact. And that's, in LCA terms, that's partially displaced fractions of hectares of land per kilogram of whatever, whatever. That's not very emotionally resonant with the consumer, it turns out. And so we have had to try to, how do we take the science of life cycle impacts and put that in a form that people can understand and that is emotional in some way, but still is scientifically rigorous? And it turns out many other initiatives, the US EPA basically has focused all of their public work around human health and the environment as it affects human health. The USDA organic standard, which is an environmental standard about soil and farm practices, is really branded as a health standard. And Americans think of it as a healthier milk rather than it is a standard around the use of pesticides on a farm. And so that really is a struggle for us. And we're trying to use kind of learnings from this kind of behavioral psychology work on what actually resonates, what actually will empower people to make better decisions without it being deceptive or overly emotional. But that really is, for most consumers, where they're at. They're at protecting what goes in, on, and around themselves and their family. That's the starting point. And then for some, it goes out to kind of community environmental health and then global environmental health. And but starting with where people at, I think, really is critical to make this work and grow.
I think we have time for two more questions. Take that one.
Thank you. This morning, Dr. Lee raised a question with the other panel. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
How closely do you work with the rest of the governments in the host countries where your supply chains are? I want to throw that question around for you. As much work as you do understanding what supply chains need to be able to do and deliver to bring product into this country, for instance, how closely do you work with the government here? How influential are you with the government here to change policy and put that in play where instead of trying to get to the individual consumer, you're actually bringing policy around through the government?
Who was the question to?
It's probably more in the electronic space where you might be able to comment, but Dara, you've done a lot of work on consumer product rating, so you might be able to take that on as well.
I can address the issue from a end-of-life type standpoint. The places where I spend my time to work with the government is more on issues of the movement that we've talked about. So, you know, the Basel Convention is an international treaty. They bring together 170 countries who are the decision makers, the parties that be, and you know, there's all sorts of dynamics associated with that, and we're actually working directly with people from individual governments on how these policies will impact them, either intentionally or unintentionally, to try to make them aware of what's going on before they put something in place rather than after. And that can be challenging, to say the least. I mean, we're working those issues at industry association levels. We're working those issues at company levels. But I'm not sure that that's really directly answering your question as you asked it, but that's sort of from my experience base.
I'm not sure if this answers your question, but I think it might. For us, there are two. We don't directly work with government, but there are sort of two levels of interaction for us. One in the consumer countries, let's say in the U.S., and then on the ground in the countries where we work directly in the supply chains. Here, there are government agencies that are collecting and disseminating information on goods made with forced and child labor, for example. So the department, U.S. Department of Labor, maintains a list of goods made with forced and bonded labor. And to the extent we interact, it is a part of our organizational agenda to make sure the product we're working on is on that list, as long as we know it's a problem. And so we absolutely advocate, talk to the people in the relevant office, and provide a lot of information at the time that they're working on the list and publishing their annual reports and that kind of thing. So we're active in that way. There are a few different lists. There's a one that's related to the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. There'll probably be some new things related to a new executive order on trafficked labor, so that'll be related to government procurement. But to that extent that we can provide that information and meet with the relevant parties and the in State Department and labor as well, we do it. And then in a completely different way, and I'll give an example in India. I mentioned before that the law in India related to education, and one of the things we're doing, if you think about this label for us, it's not just supply chain monitoring. When a company signs with us, when they want the certification, it gives our team on the ground, let's say in India, access to entire communities to provide assistance to develop, to achieve social good. And one of the things we're doing as an example is documenting all of these villages that have no access to schools, documenting the villages, going to the state governments and advocating for the schools. And over time, the schools will be there. By law, they're supposed to be there, but the communities need advocates. So it's a completely different way, but it's an important way.
And I would just say, basically, I would argue that there is no functioning form of global governance that is effectively regulating global supply chains around the world, that we have a problem from consuming countries to producing countries where there's no either existing governmental or intergovernmental system that functions right now. So the global economy has moved way past our ability to govern these systems. And so Good Guide is essentially an experiment, one of many that's responding to this vacuum and failure of governments to do their job in regulation and governance and protection of labor rights and human rights and environmental. And I think we're going to see more and more non-governmental governance initiatives that will be popping up, that will be applying regulatory-like demands on brands and retailers than we've ever seen before in totally different forms than we've seen before.
Okay, last question.
Just picking up on what you just said, is it possible for governments to do their job? And that's a serious question. How would you want them to step up?
So I think obviously governments around the world are under intense budgetary pressures. So the agencies that we deal with are underfunded, understaffed, and in many places there's extreme pressure for advancing economic development, for building whatever, jobs, factories, dams, that go against the incentives for regulating the environmental, social, health impacts of those. So there's huge pressures against the government doing its job right now. Global economy is moving way faster than any government, and governments are mainly bankrupt around the world. So they're in a tough position. My position would be as a starting point that governments should focus on the things that don't cost them a lot, that aren't requiring kind of setting up their own policing apparatus. And so I'm very interested in information forcing initiatives, the government playing a role of pushing transparency. So Majan mentioned the toxics release inventory in here in the U.S. phenomenally successful initiative that cost the U.S. government almost no money, that changed the whole dynamic of companies disclosing pollution from factories. So I think there's huge roles still for governments in establishing the rules of the game, setting standards, forcing transparency out in the market, and then enabling innovative initiatives like all of you and we are involved in to take that and do things with it. So I think there is a critical role for government, but not much likely in the near future of us, you know, in the U.S. Washington, D.C., I would say, is completely a mess. Very little potential for new regulations, new standards coming out of D.C. anytime soon. So we should be looking at local-level initiatives or international initiatives.
Okay. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.